All right, if you are here now or if you're remaining here since our last session, this is Scheme Update 8. It's the New South Wales Lifetime Care Scheme and Lifetime Care Support Authority in South Australia. And we're lucky enough here to be joined by Rohit Mandana and Rick Howe. How we'll be running today is we're going to give each a little bit of space to describe their schemes, tell us what's up. We're going without slides today, so we'll have a proper conversation here, so feel free to join in. The microphone is there. Post questions to the things as they come up. I'll be trying to answer them. I do have a few of my own, but I much prefer to ask your questions and making sure we're meeting your needs. So with that, who would like to kick off? Rohit, would you like to take us away and give us an update of Lifetime Care Scheme in New South Wales?
Yeah, sure thing. Thanks, Ash. And good afternoon, everyone. As Ash mentioned, we've got the pleasure of entertaining you all without slides, so which means you've got to listen to us, and there will be a pop quiz at the end, so please stay tuned. So I'll start with a brief update on the New South Wales Lifetime Care and Support Scheme. So the scheme's essentially established to provide treatment, rehab and care support to people who have had a traumatic accident on a New South Wales road and is a no-fault scheme. So the scheme was established in 2006 for children and in 2007 for adults. In New South Wales, we also provide administration services and support to the ACT Lifetime Care and Support Scheme as well. To contextualize some of the services and support that we provide to our participants, it's a range of services. It's really essentially geared towards first understanding the goals and objectives of our participants post injury, and then how we can essentially work with them to individualize and ensure that we're supporting them on their treatment and recovery journey. So some of these services include attendant care, rehabilitation and therapy, hospital and medical services for our spinal injury cohort, a range of equipment to essentially help give them and empower them with greater mobility, and lastly, modifications to people's homes. And this is really directed towards ensuring that we can help people have places or homes that they can move back into that are they're more accessible, help them lead greater empowered and more supported lives post-injury. Moving on to the participant snapshot. So in August this year, our scheme ticked over the 2,000 participant mark. So as of last month, we now have 2,020 participants in the scheme. And to just give you a quick breakdown in terms of the snapshot. So we've got just under three quarters, so 74% with traumatic brain injuries, 23% with traumatic spinal injuries, and 3% which comprise others, which is essentially amputees, burns, and blindness. Over the last couple of quarters, we've seen quite an elevated uptick in terms of both across the brain injury cohort increase in numbers as well as severity. While we've seen over the nearer term, that uptick is still very much in line with the longer term forecasts for the scheme, which is roughly between forecasted growth is somewhere between 5 to 7% over the next 7 to 10 years before we see potentially numbers plateauing. I touched on the ACT scheme, so there's 41 participants in the ACT scheme that we provide services and support to. Moving on to funding and financials. So from a funding perspective, the scheme is funded via levies via the CTP green slip and also through investment income. The scheme is in a really strong and sustainable position, and that's largely due to a very favorable run across with investment markets over the last 12 to 18 months. And so this has meant that both insurance ratios as well as our funding ratios have continued to be very strong and sustainable. I'd now like to touch on our service delivery model. So back in July this year, we rolled out a new service delivery model. And there's three key components that I'll touch on. The first one was we've utilized quite extensively data insights and analytics to better understand how we can support and serve our participants. So the first thing that we've done is we've better aligned our teams to the local health districts in New South Wales, and also with set them up to better support participants, and also starting to overlay things such as our provider data, so we can work collaboratively with our providers as well in terms of better supporting and serving participants. The second thing that we've done is we've looked at across the different roles in our frontline team, looked at better aligning experience and capability with complexity. And then the third thing is we've looked to tackle both the twin challenges of well-being and workload across the front line by introducing the concept of weighted caseloads and also right-sizing our caseloads to ensure that there's more sustainable workloads, which ultimately will improve well-being as well across the team. And I'd like to finish up with touching on technology. So there's a range of things, but the one thing that I'll shine the spotlight on is some work that we're doing in the assistive technology space. And this is a partnership that we launched in December last year, along with the Ingham Institute of Applied Medical Research with three universities, so Sydney, Monash, and Charles Sturt. And this was all about making assistive technology accessible to our traumatic brain injury participants in rural locations, because as you can appreciate, they don't often have the same opportunities as people in metro areas. And so utilizing technology to help with a range of things such as attention, memory loss, establishing goals and helping increase motivation, as well as moving one's body. And so there's a range of technology aids, from things such as sensors, wearables, looking at assisted living in the home, and also then things such as smart speakers and lighting. This program also has an additional component which is geared towards supporting people from First Nations communities. So we're further looking at how we can make these services more inclusive as well. So that's a very quick snapshot. I will now hand over to Rick.
Thanks, Wirt. I'll try and give you a similar sort of theme for what's going on with the Lifetime Support Authority in Adelaide. It's worth noting that our scheme kicked off on the 1st of July 2014 and is modelled fundamentally on the New South Wales scheme. So many of the things that Wirt has said apply very much to what we do. But there are a couple of things that are well worthy of noting. In South Australia, we are, I think, unique across the NIIS schemes as being the only standalone, single-purpose statutory authority that is dealing with motor vehicle-only lifetime claims. So it does give us concentration of purpose. We don't have to think about what the workers' comp portfolio is doing with our friends along the road or anything. We are focused solely on that aspect. Great for concentration. I'm not quite so sure it's so great for efficiency, but we'll worry about that at a later point. Obviously, we deal with the very seriously injured, the same five cohorts of injured types. Again, worthy of note for we have brain injury, spinal cord injury, amputations, burns, and blindness. Our ratios are a little different. We still have around about 70% of our participants in the brain injury space. But our amputee cohort is very different to everybody else's because not long after the scheme started, a decision was made to lower the threshold for amputations. And in essence, we take anybody with an amputation where they're either through the wrist or through their ankle or above, which means that we have around 15% of our participants are actually amputees. That leaves about 14% who are spinal cord injured. And actually rounded to the nearest whole percent. It's technically zero in the other categories, but we do have two burns victims as part of the participant base. We've grown through 400 participants this year. We finished the financial year at 30th of June with 401. We're up around 420-something at this point in time. I'm not sure if this is a reflection of personality types, but 75% of our cohort are male, only 25% female. We have around 65% or two-thirds of our participants in the metro area, around 30% in regional areas, leaving the balance, which is about 5 to 7%, are either interstate or overseas. We do look after people overseas. Some schemes choose to, some don't. We accept around about 50 new people a year. So our 400 or so now should be 450 at the end of the year. But we do see exits. Last year's numbers were actually a little higher than our ordinary expectation. We had 60 participants accepted for the financial year. That's at, well within the statistical expectation, but at the higher end. But we also had a record number of exits. We had 9 people who passed away, which is a little more than expected, but we had 17 participants who exited the scheme because their injuries improved to a level where they were no longer qualifying, which is great social outcomes from that point of view. A net increase of 34 for the scheme for the year is absolutely in line or actually slightly lower than our expected growth. Roy talked a little bit about the expectations in the future. Our scheme is growing by roughly 40 participants a year at the moment, and we'll keep on doing that for the next decade or so. Eventually, as the scheme gets bigger, the number of deaths increases, and that will eventually bring it into equilibrium. Best guess from our actuaries puts that somewhere around 40 years away from now. So what we do know is that we are looking at a substantial change in scale, which will be continuous for the next couple of decades, and we will have to adapt to that. In terms of the numbers, our balance sheet's sitting at around about $2 billion in terms of liabilities. It's now also sitting at about $2 billion in terms of assets, which is an achievement. Since I started at the scheme and we introduced risk-free discounting as a novel concept in the first financial year 21, we have not reported a funding ratio above 100%, and whilst it's not technically official because the document hasn't been tabled in Parliament yet, I think it's okay to say in this room that it will be reporting a funding ratio above 100% for the first time. So we're back on the direction that we want to be. Obviously, AASB 17 is going to do some messing around with that, but we'll talk about that in a bit. I also want to mention service delivery model. Like New South Wales scheme, we focus very much on individual requirements for people. We are absolutely determined to maximise independence for our participants. That might seem like a great goal from a social perspective and very altruistic, but for me, it's all about the finances. The greater independence that our participants have, the less dependence they have. 80% of our treatment, care and support liabilities are associated with attendant care. It only takes a very small reduction in that future need to actually have quite a significant impact on our balance sheet, and that's something that I'm quite excited about. So we keep focusing on how do you work with individuals to deliver the best outcome from an independence perspective for those people. And there have been plenty of presentations at this conference around thinking about some of the complexity that goes into that and how you actually identify what is the best thing to do for any individual. The last thing I want to mention is just some of the things that we've been doing internally. We have some technology things going on as well. Those of you who paid attention a couple of years ago would have heard me say that we had just launched our new core system, which gave us a technology boost from what had been an inherited system when the scheme was set up. That has capability now that will allow us to automate a whole bunch of things. They haven't yet been automated, and we are now launching into that exercise with a very deliberate view to try and free up time for the front line so that they spend less time administering the decisions that they make and more time focusing on actually working with the participants and making quality decisions, allowing the administration for that to be far less time consuming. And so we have two projects that we've just launched now, which will focus one on how we actually deliver some of those technology benefits, improved data, improved automation of the way that we do things, helping to be able to craft reports and case notes and so on in a far quicker manner than we currently do. And at the same time, then how we then leverage that freed up time to deliver better outcomes for participants. So that gives you a little bit of background on where we're at the moment. Obviously, if anybody has other questions later, dig in.
Excellent, excellent, and great overviews, guys. And you are welcome if you'd prefer to stand rather than sit on those torture devices. Do so. A couple of questions have come in. I think you'll see from the Q&A that the question on maturity, I think, has been answered, that they're quite a way away from maturity, but a really great question for Rohit. What were the drivers of the new service delivery model? Can you provide a little more detail into, you know, what influenced that decision?
Yeah, so there's a few things that we looked at. So firstly, we were looking at how do we continue to improve and enhance the support and service that we provide to our participants. And for that, one of the key things that we had to better understand was complexity. And so we spent probably about 12 months working with our data science team in terms of building out a complexity model that where we fed in 30 different attributes, which then enabled us to, through that model, develop a complexity rating on a 4-point scale from where each of our 2,000 participants now have a complexity rating from low complexity to very high complexity. And so that's meant that with those insights, we can then better align, as I was touching on, our frontline roles. And we're equipping teams with those insights, and also the introduction of a weighted caseload, so that they've got the capacity to better support and serve our participants. So the core drivers were around capacity, really a better understanding the needs of our participants, and also looking at how we can sustainably improve well-being of our staff as well.
Excellent. For lifetime care schemes, participant complexity across injury type and severity, as well as the psychosocial considerations, these can be significant issues in identifying and delivering the right treatment, care and support. How do you manage those issues and the issues this presents in a compliant manner?
I think Rohit's probably just told you that they've made a lot of changes to try and do some of that. The focus for ourselves is quite significant as well. Understanding that complexity and being able to actually identify how you respond to it, what it is that you do to be able to leverage that, is really crucial. We have some debates. It was very interesting this morning's plenary session, listening to the difficulties of dealing with a system that is set up with a bunch of rules where you're not quite getting the right outcomes, but somebody is convinced that the rule says this is the right answer, therefore that's what you get. So, advising Michael to go for a walk instead of going to the gym. We're trying to find ways to make sure that with the complexity of the participants that we deal with, we don't find ourselves giving those type of answers to our participants, and that we can really focus in on what is this that's going to make a difference for them. And for us, that then means we've got to make sure we've got flexible enough rules to be able to accommodate the variable ways of dealing with an individual. We're also trying to make sure our teams are set up to do that. We have recently moved to separate our cohort. It's now large enough that we have around about 300 people who still have what I describe as our LSA traditional model of you have a dedicated service planner that looks after you, and that's who you deal with. But we now have a large enough cohort of people who've been in the scheme long enough and are independent enough that actually they don't need somebody dedicated. They just need to be able to get someone to answer the phone when something comes up. And for those, whoever is answering the phone, to be in a position to be able to actually solve their problem for them, ideally at first go. And so actually looking at how you make that information available to them through our improved technology, having a team of people who know all of the participants that they're dealing with, so actually being able to understand and not matter who you talk to, is helping us as well, because that becomes a more reactive piece, which is appropriate for some of those people. So we are looking quite closely at how we do things. We don't necessarily have the data yet that we might like to be able to do some of that really detailed breaking down of cohorts, but we're still having a go at it irrespective based on the information we do have. And we will look to try and refine that over time.
And I might just add on, one of our learnings is that now with understanding some of the additional things that are going on in a participant's life is really useful and valuable for our case managers as well. So things such as to what extent do they have, are there any mental health problems or mental health conditions? What's their family situation like? Are they living in isolating type circumstances? Are they living in more rural locations? And I think having understanding of some of those things then enables our staff to better support them and also tailor the communication. And that's something that I think Matthew touched on this morning, which was communication is really critical for people, particularly with increased complexity and increased injury severity. And so, again, having a little bit more of a holistic understanding of what's going on with our participants enables us to best support them in some of these challenging circumstances.
Excellent. And then but perhaps we can expand that out a little bit from sort of the quality of delivery into the issues you're currently facing or some of the threats you see in relation to the just delivery of effective quality care and how these costs, how care costs in particular might be impacting your scheme sustainability.
I'm not sure how many people were in room A in the previous session, but listened to a discussion, obviously, led partly by ourselves on the issues around the cost of care and what that will actually do. As a dedicated lifetime support scheme, that is a massive impact for us from a financial perspective. And so trying to understand what those aspects will mean for us is really important. Unfortunately, I mean, we are a small scheme. We represent less than 1% of the disability market in South Australia. NDIS represents by far the vast bulk. And so what we do doesn't necessarily have that much influence on what the market is going to do in response. We have tried to control costs. We've also presented at this conference on the way we've looked at the rates that we use. We do have the opportunity to gazette rates, and we do that. And we've been able to maintain rates lower than the NDIS rates for some considerable period of time. The real difficulties, I think, are going to be at macro level in the market. There is already demand that exceeds supply in the care market when you look at it in aggregate across aged care, across disability care. There is a push potentially for increased standards in this space, which probably will make the number of workers available even more scarce. And that's also concerning in terms of the impact on price. So we are to some degree watching and endeavouring to respond appropriately. We're trying to control where we can. We're trying to build effective relationships with our partners and those who are on our panel for providing attendant care. But ultimately, we're kind of hanging on to the coattails and seeing what happens.
I guess if I look at where we've come from a cost perspective, I think over the last 8 years, the stat that I've seen recently is there's been a 45% increase in attendant care costs, and that's only going to for the factors that Rick mentioned is only going to continue over the upcoming years. So we, in addition to, given we know that demands, the rate of growth in demand is continuing, we've got to concurrently look to say how do we solve for some of the supply side challenges now. It's not something that the care schemes can solve in isolation, but I think it's tackling the problem jointly with some of the other stakeholders such as the NDIS, the aged care sector, etc. Because if we can sustainably try and tackle supply, that can over the medium term help to ease some of the cost pressures that we're all facing.
Fantastic. And forgive me as we jump around a little bit here, but there are some great questions coming through on a few different topics, so we'll bounce between them. What does each scheme consider is a reasonable funding ratio or insurance ratio to target?
This is obviously something that in my time at the LSA over the last 5 years we've actually looked at. When I arrived at the LSA in 2020, the previous annual report identified a funding ratio of, I think, 165%, which in essence said we've got bucket loads of money, we're doing great. But that can be somewhat misleading because I did a fairly rudimentary benchmarking against the other schemes and just took the number of participants in the scheme and the amount of dollars held by that fund and came up with a dollars per participant. We showed that the Lifetime Support Scheme in South Australia had less money per participant than any other scheme in the country. Yet it was reporting the highest funding ratio. So there's a disconnect there somewhere. First thing that we did, obviously, was start to move towards being more consistent. We adopted risk-free discounting at that stage, which I think almost doubled our liabilities in one fell swoop at that particular point in time. We were lucky it coincided with a 24% investment return, and so we got away without doing too much damage. But how those things get reported is obviously an interesting piece, and what your target ought to be is another piece as well. So the reality was that previously we had a standard that said that we ought to be somewhere around 150%. With that change, the board adopted a target that said we needed to be between 80 and 120% funded using that new methodology, and we've operated within that space since. AASB 17 will change the equation again, and people will have to think again from a capital management perspective what is a sensible target. But funding ratios for a pure lifetime care scheme like ourselves, where our bills are not payable next year or even next decade, but in some instances 30, 40, 50 years away, it doesn't actually matter too much if we're under 100% today. In fact, actually, there's an argument that says probably we should be. But actually finding that right balance is probably a piece that just you can spend a lot of time thinking about. Probably the most important thing is that whoever is responsible for the fund is comfortable that it's going to be able to deliver on its mandate for the period that it needs to. And if that provides comfort and you've got a target that you can operate within, then that works.
I'd say, adding on to that, is looking at from a balance sheet perspective, what is the balance sheet most sensitive to? So if you look at the asset side, so from our perspective, where the investment assets are well in excess of $10 billion, investment income is a key lever that the balance sheet is sensitive to. And so what's the what are your target volatility ranges? And then if you then think about it from the liability perspective, we know that attendant care, because for us it's circa 70% of outstanding scheme liabilities, so any movement there will have a corresponding impact. And so those are a couple of the macro factors in terms of the balance sheet. I suppose the other thing then is there's always things that play out in terms of the nearer term horizon that can have an impact. So one of the things at the moment that's impacting all our schemes is the Fair Work Commission, which is looking at the review in terms of harmonization and parity with gender pay. So that, depending on where some of those things land, that also will have a knock-on impact in terms of the outstanding liability and then, of course, the funding ratio. So again, it comes back to what is things such as those volatility tolerances. And so rather than sharing it a target zone, it's the appetite, which, and that's something well above 100%.
Excellent. And another question from the floor to both of you. Do either of you go through a process to assess from time to time to assess injury scheme eligibility in your scheme to ensure they remain appropriate for the types of injuries that are being sustained on the roads. And maybe we even go a bit further and talk about sort of subsequent or injury friends that come along with the primary injury to expand it out.
We've looked at this in a couple of cases, and obviously I've reported in our background that the board took a decision to change eligibility criteria 3 years into the scheme to broaden the amputation criteria. In the time I've been at the scheme, we've asked the board to look at two other aspects of eligibility that we deal with. One is whether or not we continue to fund people who are overseas, which is something that seems to have split right down the middle. Benchmarking I've done recently says that we have four schemes that do and four schemes that don't. So the decision we made was we're continuing to do that. But the actual criteria for all the other injuries have remained remarkably consistent. So we still apply the NIS minimum benchmarks for everything else. And my understanding is that most of the other schemes do too. So it's not so much where the rules are in terms of eligibility. For us, usually the bits that are of significance are what happens with the grey areas where you can't quite decide which side of a line somebody falls, rather than necessarily working out where the line is.
And if I start with the grey area, because that's where we have seen over the last 12 months-ish, there's been a number of instances where there have been accidents that's really stretched the definition of a motor vehicle accident, and things that have gone through a dispute process, and we've ended up admitting those cases into the scheme. And to share one example was, we had a person on who's a horseback rider, and there was a car that passed this person on the horse with a safe margin, and the horse was obviously spooked, and so this person fell off the horse and suffered a traumatic spinal injury. And so if you can just only imagine the precedence that sets in terms of other cases. So we continue to see the widening or the stretching of a motor vehicle accidents. In terms of the eligibility criteria, I think when it was set up, when the scheme was first established almost 20 years ago, I'd say that those that eligibility criteria certainly stood the test of time, and we've kind of seen that, barring these cases where the definition of motor vehicle accident has been stretched, it essentially helps us in terms of core decision making based on the 99% of participants that we admit into the scheme.
Well, perhaps we can jump into one of those stretches or something that's pretty different across schemes, and I was looking at the window of the bus last night on the way to the venue, and I thought NISQ was about to get a new claim with two people on an e-scooter, helmetless. And maybe you want to comment on the how you see the lifetime care schemes being affected by e-scooters, and it's quite different by jurisdictions in terms of their rules. Over the coming years, as the usage increases potentially.
Yeah, sure. So I think we've certainly seen a proliferation of e-scooters and e-bikes, for that matter, across all jurisdictions. And so what we know is that currently that they're not covered under existing CTP insurance. So which means that there's quite significant costs associated as incidents increase. And I think we did see some stats that was put up in the session that Sarah and EY ran yesterday on the increase in incidents and accidents. And so there is going to be quite a significant portion of costs that would need to be borne by either the users, the public or the private health insurance system, and over time, I think we're going to start to see an increase in public liability. So what I would say is that I think the key things that we need to solve for is, one, regulation. And regulation really needs to tackle three things. One is the usage, to ensure that there's safe usage of both e-scooters and e-bikes for existing users, for pedestrians, as well as other road users. We need to solve for the insurance as well. How is insurance tackled? And the third thing is on battery disposal, because that's a quite a significant, we've seen, particularly in e-bikes where they've been modified motors, etc., the incidence of fire. So it's those three things in particular. And then I think the other thing is from an infrastructure perspective, because there's a good case on how e-bikes and e-scooters are meant to solve for the last mile in terms of micro-mobility. But that requires infrastructure upgrades to ensure that, again, people can use these devices safely alongside other road users.
Yeah, I don't want to attempt to solve for some of the bigger picture issues that will come into there. In South Australia, we've had a relatively recent piece from 1 July last year. We had new legislation that took effect just before Christmas to allow private scooters to be used on the roads in South Australia. Again, looking at benchmarking across the different states, it's interesting to see that you do not have consistency, to the extent that, in fact, there are there's one state where you're only allowed to use your e-scooter on the road, and another one where you're only allowed to use it on the pavement. Obviously, there's lots of bits in between. Ours allows for both. But the bit that we're watching for, really, is that we've had hire scooters in Adelaide for a number of years and have, a reasonable handle on what the injury impact from that is. But now that the leash has been let off for private usage, we're going to expect to see a lot more on the roads. And whilst the structure currently is to exclude those people from the CTP and the lifetime care scheme, that is to say, if they cause the accident and there isn't a motor vehicle involved, then they're not covered through the schemes. We are going to see much higher incidents of e-scooter versus vehicle, and those are going to come into our areas. And watching what those numbers look like is going to be quite interesting to see where it progresses.
Indeed. Well, we have reached time, but I'm sure Rohit and Rick would be happy to take your questions in person at the front. But in lieu of that, please join me in thanking Rick and Rohit, and great presentation.